Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. If you're a regular attendee of Varsity's Roundtable meetings or any of the industry association conferences, etc., you're probably familiar with today's guest. He's Scott Townsley, Senior Advisor to Trilogy Consulting. Scott is a visionary in the senior living industry with over 30 years of experience. He's been at the forefront of helping senior living organizations navigate challenges, embrace innovation, and prepare for the future. Scott founded his consultancy, Third Age, was a partner at Clifton Larson Allen, and is the founder of Trilogy Consulting and Trilogy Connect. Scott, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation, Derek.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I've heard you talk about how you got your start as a dishwasher in a Presbyterian skilled nursing community. Can you share a little about your journey in the senior living industry and what led you to establish Trilogy Consulting and Trilogy Connect?
It's a long story that I'll make short, but you've got the beginnings exactly right. And I usually credit my brother. Casey's listening. I usually credit my brother for my entire career because he turned down the dishwashing job at that nursing home. I've been in the field for more than 50 years as it is, with the exception of about 5 years when I practiced law and was a litigator in one form or another. I've been involved in senior living, and I think the interesting thing for me, at least, was that organization that I washed dishes for, and then was mistakenly promoted to cook. After practicing law for 5 years, I came back into the corporate office as general counsel and had some other responsibilities. And then, interestingly, maybe 15 years after that, after I had gone into consulting, I was offered the CEO position, and a lot of me wanted to take it. And then I was reminded of Dirty Harry, one of his famous lines, and it's not "Are you feeling lucky today?" which was "A man's got to know his limitations." And I knew that it would have made for a great story, but I was happiest in consulting, where I've been for 35 years. So now to your question about starting Trilogy. I don't know if you've ever watched the movie Draft Day, but if you haven't, and your viewers should, it's about the NFL draft. Kevin Costner's the star, but at some point he's asked why he made a particular move by an intern, and the intern asks him the question. He looks at the intern and goes, "Because I was ticked." He actually used a different word. and so what led to Trilogy was I was kind of ticked. And what I mean by that is Clifton Larson Allen, who had acquired Third Age, which, by the way, is a great firm. I was bumping up against the mandatory retirement age for equity partners, which would have been 62. And they flew in 6 guys to Pittsburgh to meet with me to talk about how I might stay on and in what role. And I had a particular role in mind, and it didn't fit the traditional path. So ultimately, they told me, no, we couldn't do that. And I was kind of ticked. It's like, okay, well, I'm not ready to hang them up. So I formed Trilogy, and the name is an homage to Third Age. Since 2017, Trilogy has been doing consulting services primarily for nonprofit organizations. I'm mostly retired in 2022 or 2023, and Diane Burfeint has taken over the firm. So,
well, that's great. That's a fascinating story. Now, on the Trilogy website, you mentioned 3 dimensions that define the firm: strategy, vision, and innovation. Is one more important than the other, or how do all 3 work together?
That's a really good question. I put those words together fairly quickly because it seemed to me that it was much of what I had done in the professional field, and B that it just seemed like there was a relationship. And I'll describe it. The answer to the question is no, but let me explain why. And I'm going to start off with maybe a negative view of things. And the negative view would be, if you think about the organizations that have gotten themselves into trouble in our field, in the industry, the sector, whatever you want to refer to it as, it's usually because all three have not occurred. In other words, there's been no vision. There's been no innovation. It's sort of repeating the same thing that has been done for 20, 30, 40 years. And without a vision, without innovation, it's really difficult to have a viable strategy. So the positive side of it is, I think of it kind of as a Venn diagram where you take those through and when they meet in the middle, that's where the success happens. And having spent so much time in the field, and particularly on the not-for-profit side of the field, to me, the success of the not-for-profit sector is really critical. And frankly, I'm worried about that. That may be something that we talk about a bit later.
Sure, sure. Now, I guess, related to that, which of those three dimensions, strategy, vision, and innovation, do senior living communities fall short on? Or specifically not-for-profit senior living communities?
Yeah, I'm probably going to sort of word a warning to your viewers and listeners. I'm probably going to say some things in our discussion that are unsettling. And frankly, they may miff people who listen, but it's my truth. It's my observation.
And I very much respect that you're always very candid. And I've always appreciated that about our both personal and professional friendship.
Thanks for saying that. Not everyone does. But I've learned to live with that.
There you go. There you go.
I'm okay. In reality, in many instances, all three are areas where organizations fall short. But in a lot of instances, it's at least two out of three. And what I always find to be both rewarding and honest is when a CEO says to me, if we're getting involved in strategic planning, and for me, the core of a good strategic plan has to have a vision. And when a CEO says to me, I'm really not that good at vision, or I'm uncomfortable with it. And frankly, it's understandable because a lot of folks who succeed to that role are either CFOs or their chief operating officers. And so vision hasn't been a key part of what they do. And frankly, when you're dealing on the day-to-day with some of the pressures of the field, that's perfectly understandable. But when people recognize that's their shortcoming, that's when it can be addressed. It's when they don't that you end up in that situation where, one, two, or all three are missing. But it's pretty common where there's either one, two, or three are missing, and that's why I raised an alarm, frankly, with Larry Minix in the last 2 years of his service to Leading Age.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned that all three, to some degree are lacking, but you've mentioned in the past your disappointment in the lack of innovation specifically. How do you feel senior living can be more innovative, and what do you think it would take to get there?
I guess the first thing, I taught at UMBC in a graduate program in the management of aging services for a decade. And two of the courses that I taught were about innovation and entrepreneurship. And the funny thing is, I always thought that the title of the course was out of order, because it was entrepreneurship, innovation, and design. And it actually, the sequence is the reverse of that. But in any event, innovation, and boy, we could talk an hour about this, but innovation takes time and effort, and it's a process, and it needs an infrastructure and a commitment. On the other hand, it's a word that the industry has bandied about probably for the last decade, but in particular the last 5 years. I mean, it's rare to see a resume, for example, that doesn't talk about innovation, or a promotion of an organization, whether they're a provider or elsewhere, that talks about innovation. To your question, there's various ways where the sector could be more innovative. And I guess I'll hone in on maybe one or two rather than, you know, talking about multiple ways. One way is, well, first of all, to recognize that there's a need to put an infrastructure and a commitment in place. It's not just people sitting around thinking about cool stuff and that becomes an innovation. It could happen, but it really takes work.
Sure. So really understanding how you can implement it.
Yeah. I mean, and implement it and even design it. The second thing that doesn't get enough attention is that in a lot of instances, the program, we'll call it a program, the program's already in place, but the business model doesn't work. And now I'll offend some people yet again. You know, the village-to-village network is critically a success. I mean, if you look at the number of villages that have developed over the last 15 and 20 years, it's phenomenal. But if you look at the business model, other than in a very rare instance, it doesn't succeed without fundraising, donations. So the business model is flawed. And part of the reason for that is that the number of people, if you look at some of the research that's been done at UC Berkeley, the number of people who belong to the village is actually relatively small. Last time I looked, I think the average was like 130 people. And given the pricing that's in place, that doesn't work. I've said multiple times that if you look at the business model and consider non-traditional approaches, like giving it away for free or offering on a freemium basis where the majority of people get to participate in the village or many aspects of the village for free, but there's a premium to be part of the more significant services that are offered, then you could scale it to a much more significant way. And I say that not as a theory, because there was a program that we worked with that did just that. And rather than growing to 130 people, it grew to 3,000 people in the course of, I think it was like 18 months. So, you know, innovation doesn't mean having to invent something new. It could mean just finding a business model that's non-traditional to scale the thing.
Fascinating. That's a great point. Now, this is a question that I like to ask every roundtable guest. What are you looking forward to as you age?
I'm smiling because the first, when I worked at the Presbyterian Group and I came back into the corporate office, the CEO of the organization had a thing on his wall. I think it was a plaque. And then on the plaque, it said, "Aging isn't so bad when you consider the alternative." And I think of, you know, some of my younger friends who have passed away. And, you know, the answer to your question, well, first of all, I've been aging for 70 years, luckily. And I think, but I think the answer, and I, you know, I'm sorry for making it too simplistic, is what I look forward to: waking up in the morning And I don't mean that snarkily, but it's kind of like, and you know, you and I have had this discussion, when you've looked into the abyss because of a health issue, you realize that getting up in the morning is really a gift. So I don't have terribly many new expectations of aging. I probably should have some, but that's where I'd put it. I love the question, Derek.
Yeah, that's you know, well said. And you know, sometimes the simplest thoughts, the simplest perspectives are the most profound.
You know, thanks, because simple thought is my area of expertise. But I, you know, a more serious kind of note. I actually do look forward to finding some time to do more writing about things that are important. And some of them you and I have talked about in a different setting, and others I've been thinking about more recently. I'm hoping that will become a priority. And I know that's up to me, but I'm hoping I can make it a priority. Let's phrase it that way.
I think you just have to stop founding new firms.
Finding new jobs.
That's right. That's right. Now, you talked in the past about the power of critical thinking in marketing and sales. How do you define critical thinking in that context? And why do you think it's often overlooked?
If it's okay, I'm going to kind of hijack your question. I'm going to answer it, but I'm going to answer it in a slightly different way, because I do believe that critical thinking, and this will sound like Captain Obvious, critical thinking is essential in our field. It's essential in the marketing and sales area. It's essential in the leadership areas, and it's fundamentally essential at the board level, you know, particularly as we talk about not-for-profit organizations. And the thing that I've been scratching my head about, so I'm going to transition this more to governance. And so the overall, if you've got practitioners of critical thinking at the governance level, that then opens up the acceptability of it to the leadership level, which then opens up the expectation of it at the marketing and sales level. Now, and I won't take up our entire time with this, but
that's fascinating.
Board members typically are invited to be on a board because they've been successful at something. Typically, maybe it's because they're a big donor, but usually it's they've been successful at something. And invariably, when you talk to board members, and I've probably interviewed, oh gosh, I'm going to tell you 3,000 board members over 35 years, and that may be a low number. And I've been a board member of 8 to 10 organizations in the field. When you talk to them, it's clear that they're critical thinkers, that they, in their profession, in their community role, they ask the hard questions. Even if it makes someone uncomfortable. I mean, they do it politely, don't get me wrong. But yet it seems like when they get into the boardroom, that willingness to ask the hard questions disappears. And I think part of it is because, you know, typically they're not experts in senior living or aging services. So they tread a little bit lightly on that. That's understandable. It shouldn't be that way, because they bring a perspective that's new and fresh and different. But part of it, I think, also is because there's a sense that, and no one would phrase it this way, I don't think, but a sense that board members should be cheerleaders. I mean, yeah, they should help make decisions and work with strategy and build bridges to the community and all of those things, but they should be cheerleaders. And, you know, if you're the guy that starts asking tough questions, it's, you know, I had a board chair. He looks at me during a meeting when I guess I've asked a tough question. I'm going to give you an example of it in a moment. And he says, you know, Scott, you're a tough customer. And I was like, I don't think that's a compliment. Oh, no, I meant it as a compliment. So I looked up the definition of later, and there's one version where it is a compliment. There's another version where you're kind of a pain in the neck. And I think he actually probably meant both. But here's an example, and this is to the, you know, sort of senior living community side of things. It's not unusual for occupancy to be something that's referenced in a board meeting. You know, there's the financial result and here's our occupancy. And it's not unusual for it to be reflective of, here's year to date. You know, we started the year at 93%. Now we're down to 92% or something like that. Sort of incremental sort of loss of occupancy. The critical thinker would be the one who says, well, how does this compare not just to last year, but how does this compare to 5 years ago where we were? And asking that question would make some folks uncomfortable, because maybe it's not deliberately hiding the fact that there's been a deterioration over 5 years, which wouldn't be unusual, but it would certainly raise the right alarm bells. And I don't see that often enough. Occupancy is one of those issues. What I do see is that once there's an acceptance of critical questions that are part of critical thinking, it will open up the floor to more discussion like that. And that leads to a healthier organization. When you look at, you know, this is a challenging time for, you know, gosh, it's a challenging time for nursing homes in particular, but it's a challenging time, since COVID, during COVID and since COVID. And the organizations that are struggling, and you can look at board meeting minutes and you can sit in a board meeting and recognize this, or just ask yourself the question if you're on the board. The organizations that are struggling are ones that aren't practicing critical thinking. They're just kind of going along doing the best that they can, but not asking those fundamental and challenging and critical questions. So this will maybe be the third instance where I'll get myself in trouble. My fear is that the nonprofit governance model is a failed model because of this. I think there's a solution.
Which is?
Well, to me, the solution, I think the failure of the model is that you ask individuals who aren't familiar with the field to come in and serve as a board. That's not the problem. The problem then is that there's a level of being timid, of not pushing and asking. I don't want to appear, and I hear it all the time. I don't want to ask a dumb question. But it's not a dumb question. But I once had a board chair. He was a former board chair, and it was on a board that I was new to, but I had done some consulting work with him. And somebody had said something in the board meeting, like, didn't we talk about that at the last meeting? And this former board chair of the organization, he goes, you're making a big mistake if you assume that a board member remembers anything between board meetings. And I laughed at the time. And then I realized, there's some correctness to that. So my solution, and I was going to say we're starting to see more of this, but the reality is we're seeing a little bit of this, but not more of it. And it has to be done well. I think we have to compensate board members so that there's a responsibility that they assume because of the compensation. And I don't know that it has to be a lot. And there's a couple of examples of organizations out there. One in particular that comes to mind, who have made the transition within the last couple of years.
On a not-for-profit? Not-for-profit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I personally would have been aghast at the thought of me saying that out loud in a recorded podcast 5 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago. But that's my conclusion.
Interesting.
That's a salvation.
Interesting. So, you know, related to critical thinking, you've mentioned in the past the difference between actionable data and vanity metrics, which, you know, obviously, you know, used as you're processing this. And you've called occupancy a vanity metric that doesn't provide actionable insights for improvement. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, that's I have talked about that. And thank you, because it's a good illustration of the last point. Or at least it allows me to tie in the last point, or the example that I use. If you know, let's take the organization where occupancy has been incrementally declining for 15 years, and I've had one in my mind where that's been the case. Now that may seem like far fetched, but it's not. I mean, it's not the only one. But so occupancy has been declining for 15 years. Well, if you're the board member who is exercising your critical thinking skills, and you're saying, you know, it's great to see occupancy for, you know, fiscal year 2024, 2025, and thanks for showing it versus budget, thanks for showing it versus same time last year, but where were we 5 years ago? When that data comes back, you know, whether it's to the leader of the organization or comes to the board or, you know, whomever it may be, when the information comes back, it's too late because the problem's already there. So it's vanity in the sense that, you know, if occupancy is high, we feel real good about it. Our occupancy is 93%. And compared to the NICMAP data, you know, that's higher than, you know, our competitors, or, you know, in the bland market area that we have. We can feel good about that. Yeah, you know, as the cliche goes, yeah, no. Like, yeah, you could feel good about it because you're doing better than others, perhaps, but you can't feel good about it if you knew that it's a deterioration from where you were 5 years ago, and there's no sign of that changing. So in the example that I've been using, the actionable metric would have been, how much do we know about the age at move-in, and specifically talking about independent living, is using this example, the age at move-in and degree of frailty at move-in. Now, degree of frailty not frequently captured, but there could be a tracking of that, should be a tracking of that, even if it's anecdotal. Age at move-in, always, that data is always there. And, you know, the frustrating thing, you know, I mentioned I've been in consulting prior to retirement for 35 years. The ability to retrieve that data, age, for example, and there's other elements to it, is the same misery in 2025 as it was in 1985 when I first started in the consulting field. So I know that's 40 years, but I've tried to be retired for 3 to 4 to 5 years. And so, you know, there's the act. And why is that actionable? It's actionable because if the average age or median age of move-in has been increasing, and if you happen to know that the degree of frailty is increasing as well, then it's predictable that the units are going to turn over faster because the person's length of stay is going to be shorter. And that's going to trigger, we've got to invest more in marketing because we're going to have to generate X percent more sales in order to keep the units filled. But it's also predictive of the character of the independent living community is at risk of changing. And once that changes, then it makes it even more difficult to attract the kind of resident that you're trying.
Absolutely.
To.
Yep.
So, you know, in some ways it's like simplistic. And actionable data is simplistic, but the trick is to find it and use it.
Sure. No, that's a great point. So before we get into age-in-place programs or continuing care at home, continuing care without walls, whatever we want to call them, I want to read a quote from you and get your thoughts on it. You said, "When I tell you that people hate nursing homes, I'm not exaggerating. If you get a group of nursing home administrators in a room and you ask them about the potential for them to end up in a nursing home, most of them will say, I'd rather be dead." Why do you think that's true?
I said that?
No. We'll pull up the recording.
No, I know that I've said that, and I actually have said it repeatedly. Let me start with the quantitative piece. And the quantitative piece is that when we've done consumer, we being Trilogy, Clifton Larson Allen, Third Age before that, when we've done consumer research through a group that we've worked with, a fellow by the name of Dave Dougherty, and we asked some, you kind of toss up questions early just to get a person hooked, asking them early on so that they'll stay on the line. And we asked them a series of terms. And do you have a positive feeling about the term? Do you have a negative feeling? Things like home care, whew, through the roof, positive. And assisted living, pretty positive. Continuing care or life plan community, not well known. So not a lot of positive, not a lot of negative, more like, I haven't really heard about that. When you ask about nursing home, well known and very negative. For example, it wouldn't be unusual to see the negative reaction. Hey, do you recognize the term nursing home? Yes, I do. Do you have a positive or negative feeling about it? It wouldn't be unusual to have that negative feeling be somewhere between 55 and 65% of the public. Now, that doesn't mean that nursing homes are negative. That means that the public perception to start with is negative. And I can give you qualitative interactions about that, including my story about the nursing home administrators, because I didn't make that up. it's conversations that I've had, you know, having been a nursing home administrator, licensed as one, not now, and you know, clearly talking to folks a while. But let me drop to the bottom line. And this is the heretic side, and you know. When I've talked about critical thinking before, it's like you can be a hero by asking the right question, and you can be viewed as a heretic for asking the question that nobody wants to answer. I'm going to be a heretic for a moment or a moment longer. Most of the nursing home beds in the United States, including not-for-profit sector, are semi-private. That's a euphemism, semi-private. Because there's really nothing private about them. So when I think about spending the last days, months of my life or anyone's life at their most frail and vulnerable time, sharing a room with a perfect stranger, and perfect may not be the behavior is just a description. It's inhuman. And actually, there's a difference between inhuman and inhumane, and it's both. I think that's why, I mean, there's, you know, the public has all sorts of reasons for recognizing, you know, for having a negative perspective of nursing home. The stories aren't positive. You know, you really have to have had a stay in a nursing home where the quality has been great and the community has been there and the staff has done a great job. And that happens. But the majority of the population looks at this and say, you're going to put me in a 2, 3, or 4-bedded room. And by the way, 3- and 4-bedded rooms, as you know, are still in existence, shamefully. Because some number of them are with the not-for-profit sector. Now, person-directed care, person-centered care or service, that's helpful. If you understand what that is and you benefit from it, but it's not particularly well known. So you have a bad reputation coming in, you have a physical environment that should be unacceptable, but isn't. And then you look at small houses and greenhouses and say they solved the physical plant issue, but it's not widely developed. I mean, the percentage of greenhouses and small houses across the United States is infinitesimal, which is really unfortunate. And, you know, here again, we could talk about why that is. One of the reasons, quite frankly, is because there's an urban myth that building small houses, building greenhouses, and using that model to get rid of the inhumane, inhuman delivery of service that's not financially viable. And that's not true, but it's spread like wildfire. And that's unfortunate. So quite frankly, I try to carry the message. And sometimes I use the example of the nursing home administrators who I've heard say that very thing. And in other instances, I just say that semi-private nursing homes beds are inhuman. And I'll take the criticism. I'll take, somebody's offended by that. I'll take the offense. But it's a message that I'm not going to get it out by myself, but that's why I say that.
And it would be difficult to argue with the fact that that's, I mean, who would want to live in, it's one thing to be in a hospital for a short period of time, but to live your life, as you've said, in that kind of an environment with somebody essentially having a roommate in your most vulnerable time that you don't know.
You're exactly right, Derek. And it's sort of like, I used to say that the long-term care field, particularly nursing homes, tracked hospitals, lag by about 15 years, but it's no longer true. It seems like we're lagging by maybe 25 to 50 years, maybe even a century, because hospitals by and large have eliminated semi-private rooms. And most of them, are private. And I forget where I was going to go with the second part, so we'll just skip that.
Sure. Well, I do have a question, another question. You've talked about the forgotten essential non-consumer. Who is the forgotten essential non-consumer, and how can aging services organizations, senior living organizations engage with them?
I love your questions. And there's a book called Blue Ocean Strategy that was published in 2004. Don't hold me to that. It's been around 20 years ago, and it was real popular, almost fad like, for a while. And that's where I first read the description of what they called the essential non-customer. And the point that they were making, which remains valid today, is that if you want to expand a market, you've got to reach the essential non-customer. And they talk about three tiers of non-customers. One of the first tier, the easy one, is the one that's going to be a customer at some point in the near future, but they're not today. The second one is what they refer to as, I think it's the refusing. So it's like, I know what you're offering. At least I think I know. I may misconceive what it is. But I am not really interested in it. So they're refusing. And the third is the unexplored. They don't even know you're out there. So, go back to that consumer research. Hey, here's some terms we'd like you to respond to. People know assisted living. They know home care. They hate nursing homes. They don't know much about continuing care retirement communities. They don't know much about life plan communities. So that would be the tier three. Now, talk in a moment about how to get to them, but even if you got to the tier two, we'd be in a better position. So how do we do that? Well, let me give you an illustration. Too often when I say to an organization, or I've said to the organization before retiring, have you done any consumer research? The answer that I'll get, particularly for the not-for-profit sector, is yes, we have. We've done focus groups with our residents, or we've done focus groups with our wait list, or we've done focus groups with our prospects. Yeah. It's easy. There they are. But all you're hearing from is the people who are already customers. So if they've knocked on your door, they're either going to be a customer or in that tier one. So they're easy to get. But they're not going to tell us very much because they've already kind of locked into, this could be an option for me. It's reaching that second group that takes more time and effort. And bluntly, as a field, we haven't put the time and effort into it. We just haven't. And if the question is why, there's probably multiple answers. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's time, you know, we've got other things, but I'm here I go again. I'm going to put it into the category of, I'm going to call it intellectual arrogance, which is, we know what people want. Why would we ask again? And it's not, you know, it's not always, it's rarely offered like that. But this idea that we know better because we're in the industry, is pretty rampant. I think it was on LinkedIn. There was a gentleman, well-intended, who, I don't know if it was a white paper or it was just a post on LinkedIn, but he was essentially solving the challenge of life plan communities and senior living communities. And I said, oh, wow, this is right. Great. You know, maybe I can bullet. Sell this. Yeah, silver bullet. And I read it and it was like, oh, there it is again, which was, you know, people should want this. If you just tell them that you're offering X, Y, and Z, you know, with wellness and this and that, they'll come. And I'm saying to myself, no, they won't, because most of them don't know about it. And the another portion of them are sort of in aging denial. And it's not so much that they don't recognize that, you know, what they're able to do today, and they being me, you know, it's not like we're, you know, not painfully aware that things we used to be able to do, we can't do or shouldn't do now. But it's that, you know, projecting that forward, like, well, if this is where I am today versus where I was when I was 60, what am I going to be like at 80? That's not rational. That's rational behavior that doesn't happen. And we know that from asking people like me, you know, are you concerned about your future aging? Are you concerned about your potential need for services as you age? And invariably meaning the largest percentage, the answer is no. And surprisingly, it tends not to change by age. You know, so you ask the 85-year-old, the percentage is pretty similar to the 75-year-old, which is not dissimilar from the 65-year-old. You know, maybe we're all in aging denial. That's an easy label to put on it. I think it's like, you know, I see the meme on Facebook a lot, like when somebody's celebrating a birthday. And the meme is, I don't know, I've never been this age before. So it's like, you know, I don't know what it's like to be 80 because I've never been 80 before and I'm 10 years away from that. So.
Sure. Makes sense.
So the non-customer, got to dig for them. And when we dig for them, we got to listen to them. And we got to believe that what they're telling us, while it may be different than what we think, and I could give you like tons of examples of that, we have to be willing to accept it. We have to be willing to not only accept it, but embrace it and say, you know what? That's not what we've developed here. That's not what we're offering.
But I think that's great. I think that's a great point, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but that's right. I have been in so many conversations where people will be arguing with what we heard in the research, and the point of the research is to learn, not to have it simply confirm what we already know or what we think we know, I should say.
Which is, you know, we go back a long way in terms of Varsity and originally Third Age. And what I've always appreciated about Varsity is, you know, the willingness to say, this is what we've heard. It's important information. You ought to take it seriously, even in the face of, you know, the client, the person who's, you know, you can see them shaking their head. And it's like, well, I see you shaking your head, but, and you have a nice way of delivering that message.
We try. But no, that is important. That's really important. Now, you know, we've talked an awful lot over the months and years about the growing preference for aging at home. What do you see as the most significant barriers for these age-in-place programs, CCH programs, to overcome?
Yeah, we have talked about that. And I've been involved in the at-home movement. I was going to put that in air quotes, the at-home movement, since the mid-90s, maybe earlier than that. And it's just been disappointing to see how far it's not gotten. And I don't have a silver bullet either, and don't pretend to. But the idea, there's a very willing audience of tell me how I can live better at home. Now, it's not huge because you still have people who are in that aging denial that we just uses the label, but they're out there. And if you're able to tell them, here's how I can support you, and here's how it works. There is a market. I mean, providers have demonstrated there is a market. It's not a huge one. I think the flaw, the flaw that's there, Varsity does a good job of working with the at-home providers. And I remember getting ready for a conversation, another roundtable conversation, and I was scanning websites for continuing care at home or continuing care without walls, whatever you call it, providers. And I was stunned. I don't use the word dismayed a lot, but I'm going to use it here. I was dismayed, disappointed at the frequency of how often they were positioning themselves as just like long-term care insurance. So it's like theoretically, it's an easy explanation. We're just like long-term care insurance, but we're better because we're going to give you this wellness coordination element. But I think you lose people, given our earlier conversation about people hating nursing homes, comparing yourself to something that relates to nursing homes, not a good start. Particularly when you tell them that the benefit you get is financial. If you, God forbid, have to move into the nursing home, this is a way for you to manage the cost. Thank you. I'm trying to stay out of a nursing home, which is really the message, because when you look at the performance of the continuing care at home providers who have well embraced the care coordination or wellness coordination and are doing it effectively, they're reducing and or delaying the utilization of facility-based services. So to me, if I were continuing care at home provider, that's my message. That's my hook. You hate nursing homes? Us too. And we can help you stay out of them. Here's how. I think that the gem of that portion of the at-home movement is in fact the wellness coordination, the care coordination, when done effectively.
That does seem to be where there's a lot of momentum, a lot of interest, a lot of ears perk up.
Yeah.
So we know that the U.S. population is graying in increasing numbers. The projected number of Americans aged 65 and older is expected to double from 46 million to over 98 million by 2060. Yeah. You've called it an avalanche of aging consumers that our society is not ready for. How can the senior living industry be ready for that avalanche? Now we're talking, of course, 2025 to 2060, that's 35 years. A whole lot will change in 35 years, but how can the senior living sector prepare itself?
I want to give you, three ways to do that, and I'll try to give something there that would be helpful. It's really upon us. I mean, the leading age of the baby boom generation is very much at the point where they should be considering senior living options. In 5 years, the leading edge of the baby boom generation will be around the average age of a nursing home admission. So it's on us sooner rather than later. I don't mean this politically, but the government has failed us. I've been around long enough to make the statement that we've needed a Claude Pepper. He was a congressman who was really an advocate for aging and all facets of aging, including what was needed to support individuals as they age. It's not there in our federal government. Maybe it's in some of the state governments. So you take that piece out of it. And you know, when I've practiced my futurist skills, the area that I've gotten wrong repeatedly is to say, and I talked about this in 85 and 95. And I was saying, you know, by the turn of the century, there'll be a new way of funding aging services. Nope. And here we are.
By the turn of which century?
Good point. Maybe that's what I should say. Yeah.
That's right.
the need to revise funding is still there, and it will only come as a result of a crisis. So I'm going to park that off to the side. I think that some of the things that we've talked about, can be ways for the sector to prepare. And, you know, this should be a time when, you know, those of us who have worked in this sector and those who are providers are buoyant about the possibilities. And I think there is some buoyancy out there. Yeah, you know, this. You know, people are turning the right age. They're going to need our services. That's great. But we have to design differently, and we have to do it quickly. So the intellectual arrogance, we got to get that out of our mindset. And that's an individual thing. You know, I can do that. And if I'm a CEO and I'm able to do that, then my organization can do it. If my organization can do it, if I can convince my board, now what might have seemed like a risk is really no longer a risk. It's a compelling reason to change. So intellectual arrogance is important. I think the second thing would be maybe stop feeling the necessity to invent, but look around, because, you know, take something that's already there and figure out how to scale it, how to tweak it, you know, like the village-to-village network. That could be a significant solution. But not in the model that it has. We've talked about this. You're probably going to get mail and emails because of what I'm about to say. And what I want to say is focus. Not you.
Sure, yeah.
You are focused. But the sector, focus on what's important. Focus on what's important. And bluntly, ageism is important when it comes to employment. You know, ageism is less of an issue than the ability to support an aging population. Now somebody may tie those two together, and I'm open to considering that. And I'm not. I'm trying not to be critical of the anti-ageism efforts. But look. You want to be ageist around a baby boomer, you're going to pay the price. Right now, it doesn't bother me when a waitress or waiter calls me, well, typically it's not a waiter, but a waitress calls me sweetie. I'm like, you know, I think I am sweet. So it doesn't bother me. For some people, if it does bother them, they won't come back. And they'll find another place where they don't feel like that's there. We have to focus. Because this is a heavy lift, societally a heavy lift, and it's a huge opportunity. And as I said, and you know, I've been very active in the not-for-profit sector, both as a volunteer board member and also as a consultant. If we don't do these things, if we don't focus, it's the for-profit sector that's going to take it away.
Absolutely right.
And that's what I said to Larry Minnix 2 years before he retired. And he, you know, I love Larry Minnick. So I love his Southern accent. But I felt like, you know, whether it's, I think it was maybe 10 years ago, that it was evident that the not-for-profit sector was already losing market share. All you have to do is look at some of the Ziegler data that's provided to know that the sector is losing market share. At some point, it becomes irrelevant. And I think the need to scale services to meet the demand is where that's, you know, to take Malcolm Gladwell's point, that's going to be the tipping point.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So how would Scott Townsley describe the perfect senior living community?
The former professor in me wants to change the question, but I'm not going to change it. I'm just going to add to it. Because I was watching some of the episodes and the podcast episodes are great. So thanks for the invitation, because it enabled me, called me to watch some of the things. And here's how I would change the question or add to the question. What would be the perfect senior living community for me? And I've thought about it, because, you know, my wife and I have had this conversation and we dialogue about, we're not in a geography right now where continuing care at home is an option, could be at, you know, at some point. So we've thought about communities, and it would need to answer your question. It would need to be waterfront, and I'd need a sunset or sunrise view. So that needs to be important, or that needs to be in place. Craft beer on tap. Shout out to Westminster. Westminster of the Blue Ridge, Westminster Canterbury of the Blue Ridge, for having Gary Salmisi, who's since retired, for having craft beer on tap.
That's great.
There. Craft beer on tap. And then the last piece of the puzzle would be data-driven with predictive modeling. And what I mean by that is I want to be in a location, whether it's an at-home program or a community, where certain things that I'm doing, you know, whether it's a health condition, whether it's a behavior, that a team, the staff can look and say, oh, Scott's up, stop eating this. Because if you keep that up, you have a higher percentage of chance of having X. And, you know, there's, not to get off the topic, but just real quickly, data is so critical, but so underutilized, and, you know, topic for another day. But that would be largely it. I skew toward introvert on the scale of introvert versus extrovert. So a smaller setting, lots of books available to me, and things to do that aren't in large groups. So I'll be put off, for example, by getting an activities calendar that shows me 37 things going on at the same time with large groups. It'll be like, oh, that's interesting. I'm not joining any of those groups. So that's what's right for me. And what's right for you is probably different.
And that's a great way to put it, because, I mean, you're right. At the end of the day, it is such a personal decision, such a personal connection you have to make.
And you know, and a piece that I didn't include is we don't have kids. We have people who are like kids to us. So, you know, being geographically proximate is important, but probably not as critical to me as it would be to to you, for example,
Sure, or others. Sure. So what role do you see technology playing in addressing the needs for this growing aging population? Are there any specific advancements or trends that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, well, excited.
Or intrigued with.
Yeah, I'm bordering between intrigued and excited. 1988, I did a presentation at Leading Edge Pennsylvania. It was PANFA back then.
Sure.
And it was on workforce challenges, which we had back then, of course we have now. And I had done some research and talked for the first time about robots in nursing homes. And people laughed out loud. which I've gotten used to in presentations that I do. They're not always laughing at the jokes.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, it's been a slow go, but I can get excited about the use of robots. And I can understand the hesitancy. You know, this is a high touch field. Yeah, it is. But robotics can play a really significant role that enables the human staff to have more high touch than they would have otherwise. So I watch that. I watch for how that's working its way, and it's going way too slow. But has the potential to build momentum. The second thing is, there's really three dimensions. The second thing is autonomous vehicles. And I've had enough learning and discussion, had a board chair who was an ex-GM guy, and he was cautioning me on enthusiasm about autonomous vehicles for good reasons. And so it may be that we never see autonomous vehicles on the streets. We do occasionally see them within a retirement community or planned community setting. But I think where the autonomous part may be beneficial is to protect the older driver from making a mistake that they otherwise would have made, and protect the public too. And I see dimensions of that in newer cars. We talk about that, but I'll skip through that. The third thing on the technology side is the ability to address isolation. And I think that we learned a lot during COVID about how to do that, but then also the ability of a quote older adult or senior to use the technology to de-isolate themselves. Yeah. if that's a But then, you know, having said all of that, I don't know if you're probably familiar with Irving Stackpole, consultant. I enjoy his presentations and kind of got a dry sense of humor. But one of the things that he's developed a sort of a term which is talks about our sector, says the industry that technology has left behind, and there's some truth to that. So I'm enthused, I'm excited about things, I'm watching, I'm patiently waiting, but I'm also realistic to say that the dollars necessary aren't easy to come by, and the investment that the sector makes is painfully low in technology. At least we've moved away from the discussion of investment in technology being how many licenses we can afford for Microsoft 365.
You're absolutely right. It is a challenge. And I guess the reality is technology is obsolete almost as soon as you take it on. And if you've got a sector that has limited resources, et cetera, it can be a challenge. But you're right; it has to be planned for, and it can't be left behind. So, last question: what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
Ooh, two things just popped into my mind. One is, I would have spent less time drinking cheap beer. Yeah. But that's probably not the
answer. Hey, but if that's what you'd have told your younger self, no rules.
Okay, fair enough. The other thing is, and I'll probably need to explain this. I'll try not to take too long because we've had a great conversation. I'm probably running long on you. I would have said to myself, sport, you need to hurry up and know yourself. And what I mean by that is, I was in a hurry to achieve things. And I, I was a practicing attorney at the age of 23. I left high school early. I was in college before most people were. I got through law school. It took me 3 years, but I was 2 years younger than the youngest people. Most of the youngest people that were in the class. And I was trying cases at the age of 23. I was in a hurry to get stuff done. And I don't think I took the time to learn who I was. And so just I'll give you two examples. It was 1994, and I'm 94, 95. I'm reading a book called The Rise and Fall of Strategic Planning by Henry Mintzberg, a quirky professor out of Canada. And I'm reading on a flight from LA to Philadelphia, and I'm fixated on this book because it's in a particular chapter, he's describing me. And it's the first time that I've looked at myself and been able to say, this is why I find strategy so appealing. And this will sound really immodest. And this is why I think I'm pretty good at it. And so, you know, in 1994, I'm 40 years old. And for the first time, it's like, boom.
That's
less embarrassing than the second one. The second sort of learning is, I mean, I always recognize that there was a certain shyness to me. But what I didn't recognize was that it was the introvert part. It wasn't just being shy. There was much more to it. And that would have been about 2012. So, you know, 12 years ago, I'm not a young guy at that point. And I read a book called Quick, or Quiet, rather. And there in the book, and there was a there was a TED Talk on it, but I had read the book first. There in that book is a description of the value, the strengths, the distinction of somebody who's tends toward the introvert side. So, you know, if I had to talk to my younger self, get to know yourself, Scott. You know, don't spend so much time trying to achieve. Spend some time trying to understand you, because then you might achieve more.
That's amazing. Because there's a lesson there for all of us. And, you know, I get that with age comes wisdom, you know, to some degree at least, because education, everything, all the life experience leads to that. But if we could accelerate that, and if, I mean, we obviously we spend all of our time with ourselves, but if we could really get to know ourselves, that's really smart. And drink better beer.
I drink better beer. Yeah.
Well, Scott, I could keep going for hours, and we'll have to continue this conversation next time. We'll have you back. But thank you very much for your time, your wisdom, and your friendship all these years.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for being a friend. Thanks for asking questions that make me think. Really appreciate that.
Absolutely. Well, I have to give a lot of the credit for that. And thanks to Dave Schaffner, who is our producer, as well as Matt Campbell, our engineer. So thanks again, Scott. And
my pleasure.
Everybody, we'll see you next time on Varsity Roundtable Talk.